From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. It's Radon Action Month, and today we discuss the dangers of radon, how to test for it in your home, and how to get rid of it. My guests, Rick Welke of the Iowa Department of Public Health Radon Program, and radon mitigator Mark Mitchell. Before that, though, Dr. David Servan-Schreiber. 1995, Servan-Schreiber discovered he had a malignant brain tumor. Then over the next 15 years, he researched the body's natural cancer-fighting capacities and then described them in his New York Times bestseller, Anti-Cancer. He'll be on in the first part of our hour. How to protect yourself from radon and everyday choices that may help prevent cancer. First, a look at the hour's news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A little later in the hour, we'll talk about Radon Action Month, how to test for radon in your home, how to get rid of it, of course, the dangers of radon. That coming up in our second half hour. My first guest is Dr. David Servan-Schreiber. He is a clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine, co-founder of the Center for Integrative Medicine, also a founding member of Doctors Without Borders. In the mid-1990s, Dr. Servan-Schreiber discovered he had a malignant brain tumor. Over the next 15 years, he researched the body's natural cancer-fighting capacities and then described them in his New York Times bestseller, Anti-Cancer. Published in 2007, Anti-Cancer has sold over 1 million copies worldwide. It's been published in over 30 languages. Now, Anti-Cancer has just been published again in a new edition by Viking. He is also the author of the book, The Instinct to Heal. Dr. Servan-Schreiber lives in Pittsburgh and Paris. At the moment, he is in Paris, from where he joins us this afternoon. Good evening to you, Dr. Servan-Schreiber.
Good afternoon to you.
Anti-Cancer, as I mentioned, came out originally in 2007. You have a new edition with the latest research on how to fight cancer. What has changed so dramatically in the past 2 years that you felt you had to update it this quickly?
Well, it's been amazing. The journey has been incredible. I mean, I discovered I had cancer 17 years ago, and as a physician and scientist, it was a very harsh discovery. But I learned that I could use my own skills to find out everything that's helpful in the scientific literature to make my body more resistant to the cancer process in addition to the conventional treatments. What has happened in the last 2 years is that there's been even more scientific research demonstrating the importance of helping your body along to prevent cancer from ever developing or to really help it resist if you have developed the disease in complement to the conventional treatments. And when the book first came, was first published a year and a half ago, there was a fair amount of skepticism that this could be true, you know, that there was real science that showed that you could actually do things by yourself to help resist cancer. But with the new discoveries, it's becoming much more accepted. And in fact, the book is more successful now than it was a year and a half ago.
Dr. Servan-Schreiber, what do you put at the top of the list as far as revelations about cancer treatment or cancer prevention that you've included in this latest edition?
One study, for example, that is almost the very testing of the lifestyle program I put in the book, it looked at women who had been treated for breast cancer at Ohio State University. All of them had gotten state-of-the-art treatment. One part of the group was then told, well, just to go back to your life as usual, we'll follow you and catch cancer early if it comes back. And the other part was told to change how they eat, include more physical activity in their daily routine. They learn how to manage stress with the basic breathing exercises and by reaching out to their friends. And that's all. Now, they learned that for a few months. Then they were followed for 11 years. 11 years later, the women who had learned to make changes in their lifestyle had a 68% reduction in mortality. Now, this is not just that they felt better. Mm-hmm. 68% reduction in mortality.
How large were the sample group? How large was the group?
220 women, randomly divided into two groups. So it is a very convincing test of the hypothesis that you can really help your body resist cancer better and improve your chances of survival. If this study had been about a drug, I guarantee you that it would be malpractice not to be giving this medication to people. But because it's about something that's free, that's not patentable, that nobody can make money with, we're not hearing nearly enough about those kinds of interventions.
You offer a lot of advice in this book in preventing fighting cancer that has to do with everyday activities, diet, household product use, fitness, mental health, many, many ways in which a person can change everyday actions to inhibit cancer cell development. Let's talk about a few of them here. Before we do that, though, take us back to the mid-90s. People might wonder how you discovered you had a malignant brain tumor. You are a doctor at this point. You were doing a brain scanning experiment?
That's right. I'm a scientist as well as a physician. I did a PhD in neuroscience under a Nobel laureate, and by the time I was doing my training in neuropsychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh, I already had a neuroimaging lab, so I was doing brain scanning experiments. And one evening, one of the subjects didn't show up for the experiment, so I didn't want to waste the scanner time. I got into the scanner myself, and my colleague and best friend told me from the scanner room that there was something wrong. Then he came into the room, pulled me out of the machine, put his hand on mine, and said, "David, there's something in your brain, and we can't do the experiment." And that's how I discovered I had brain cancer.
Did you just disbelief, I imagine, at first? There must be something wrong with the scanner, or?
Well, I thought it was somebody else's scan, you know, that was left over on the screen or something.
A mistake, yeah.
A mistake that somehow the computer was showing me somebody else's brain. But, you know, it was quite clear that there were so many different images that it was me.
What has become of your cancer in the meantime? 17 years ago, that was.
Yes, so I immediately had conventional treatment, and it saved my life. You know, of course, I was very lucky because this was discovered early. I had no symptoms. So I stood a very good chance of this being taken out entirely. But these kinds of cancers don't let themselves be taken out so easily. And a few years later, I relapsed. I had to have, brain surgery a second time. Then I had chemotherapy and radiotherapy. And to this day, I live with these brain tumor cells in my brain because you can never get rid of all of them. That's the whole problem with brain cancer.
So there's never been an operation to remove the, I believe, walnut-sized tumor in your brain.
No, there was. We took it out, but it came back a few years later, and I had a second surgery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How did you as a doctor experience that shift from to becoming a patient?
It's awful. I hated it. You know, the one of the most amazing things is I was a consultant in the very large Pittsburgh University Hospital, and I was walking around the hospital all day long, but when I would be waiting for my MRI, they would force me to be carried in a wheelchair. And I kept saying, "Look, guys, I'm walking around. I'm doing consults. You know, mm-hmm. What do you want me to do?" And they said, "Well, this is hospital policy. You know, we have to wheel you to the scanner." And it was such a humiliation. I remember that. But it made me realize that this must be happening to a lot of other people. You know, it's not just doctors. And I think about a year or so after this whole thing, when I recovered from the surgery and went back to work, and I became a much better doctor because mm-hmm. I knew what people were going through.
Much more empathy for your patients, and you knew in a different way how to treat them.
That's right. And I knew the anguish of the loneliness in the hospital room, the anxiety waiting for test results, and the doctor not calling and so on. And so I became a much more caring physician.
Let's go back to the advice that you give in this latest edition of Anti-Cancer. Many more things than we can mention in these brief minutes we have together, but let's talk about some of them. You predict that cell phones will be considered the new cigarette in 20 years. Update us on information. What do we know about cell phone use and how it may contribute to cancer?
It's very interesting. The vast majority of studies that have looked at cell phone use and cancer risk find no relationship. But practically all of these studies have been done on less than 5 years of cell phone exposure, many of them on less than 2 years of cell phone exposure. Now, if you had people smoke 2 packs a day of cigarettes for 5 years, you would see absolutely no effect on cancer rates. So I'm saying you can take all of these studies and not even read them, you know, tear them apart, put them in the trash. Now, look at the few studies, and there's only a handful, that have examined the effect of 10 years or more of cell phone exposure, of 1 hour a day or more. That's like, you know, I would say the equivalent of smoking a pack a day for a significant amount of time. Then what happens is you do see a signal there. You know, these studies find roughly a doubling of the risk of a brain tumor on the side on which people say they were using their phones. I don't think that's a proof. And, you know, none of the scientists that have been involved with me in making that statement that we need to be more careful about cell phones are saying that there's a proof out there. But what we're saying is that this is the kind of signal we were getting about cigarettes at the beginning. It's the kind of signal we were getting about asbestos at the beginning, when we should have been paying more attention. So we're saying we need to pay attention. And we, the people who use cell phones, you know, and I have a cell phone, even though I have brain tumor cells in my head, we need to be more careful with how we use our cell phones, while we're waiting for more definitive scientific information.
Isn't it important that years ago the cell phone manufacturers redirected the antenna on a cell phone, redesigned the cell phone, and gave many of us the impression that they were much safer because of it?
Yes. You know, in fact, what I'm pushing is for the industry to stop denying that there's any kind of problem and to take the problem head on and start developing technology that is safer and safer. And I think, you know, the one provider or the one cell phone manufacturer who will be able to show in 10 years that they were the most preoccupied about health and safety will actually be the most successful one in 10 years from now.
What tips can you give us in the meantime about a cell phone use?
Well, use it as little as you can. Whenever you have a chance, call back from a landline. And when you use it to send text messages, because the duration of the signal is much shorter. If you have to talk on your phone, make sure you use a headset.
Use the hands-free. Keep the main module away from your head,
so that you can keep the phone away from your head. Yes, and the further you keep it away from your head, the less exposure you get. The amount of exposure drops very rapidly as you take the phone further away from your head.
Okay, and again, you're saying there's not a direct cause, studies that don't show this, but in the meantime, to be as a precaution, this would be an intelligent thing to do.
I'm saying we don't have a definite proof, but there's enough concern that it's safer to use it in that way.
Okay, we have to take
but
a short...
the book isn't about cell phone.
We have to take a short break. Please stay on the line. Dr. David Servan-Schreiber joining us from Paris today, author of the New York Times bestseller Anti-Cancer, just out in a new edition, clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. Do you have a question about cancer or cancer prevention? In the next 10 minutes, we have Dr. Servan-Schreiber with us. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in 60 seconds. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, talking in this half hour with Dr. David Servan-Schreiber, author of the New York Times bestseller Anti-Cancer. Joins us from Paris. Lots of advice in this book in preventing, fighting cancer that has to do with everyday activities, diet, household product use, fitness, mental health, research, 15 years of research about the body's natural cancer-fighting capacities. And let's talk a little bit about plastics. A lot of concern about the use of plastics over the last recent years, plastic containers for our food and drink in the microwave. Cooking with them, drinking out of them. It's very hard to separate fact from fiction. Dr. Servan-Schreiber, what can you tell us about the latest studies and the potential dangers of plastics?
Well, it's becoming very clear that some types of plastics, not all, but some types, especially the hard polycarbonated plastics that are used, say, for sports bottles and for many microwave containers, in which people heat up food and liquids, when they're in the contact of hot liquids or hot food, they leach out something called bisphenol A or BPA. And the problem with that BPA is that it acts on the body very much like a hormone would, and it can promote the growth of a variety of cancers. And it's been shown even just last year, which is in the new edition of the book, because I didn't know that before. It's been shown that that can prevent chemotherapy from killing some types of cancer cells, just to be exposed to the amount of BPA that can leach out of plastic containers when we warm up liquids in them. So one of the advice that people should have is do not warm up liquids in your microwave in a hard plastic container. You know, use glass or ceramic or some other type.
Even though some plastics would be safe in the microwave?
Some, but you need to make sure that, you know, usually you're not going to put soft plastic in a microwave because it might melt with the hot liquid. So, you know, the plastics that are safer are the plastics that are used, for example, for the mineral water bottles. They have a number one underneath. That's safe. It's the number seven that contains BPA.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about food synergy, which you talk about in this book, foods. What is food synergy?
One of the most interesting things is that a variety of foods, especially plants and mostly vegetables, contain plant-based chemicals that actually help kill cancer cells or make the body less likely to let cancer grow in it by preventing the growth of new blood vessels, for example. Now, the fascinating new discovery is that when you combine several of these vegetables that have anti-cancer plant-based chemicals, when you combine them, they're much more powerful than one taken in isolation. So, for example, a new study found that we've known for some time that broccoli has a lot of anti-cancer chemicals in it. We've known that tomato sauce also is powerful at slowing the growth of prostate cancer, for example. What was found is that when you combine broccoli and tomato sauce, you get a much stronger effect than you could ever get from each separately, which is great news because this is how we eat. We actually combine foods when we eat. So it suggests that if you start developing a diet that is based on a combination of a wide variety of anti-cancer foods, you can get a very powerful effect on slowing down cancer in the body.
Are there any cancer myths prevalent that you would like to explode?
Well, the number one is that you can't do anything about cancer, that it's a genetic problem, that you know you got it because your parents had it or someone in your family did. And that is completely false. That we know, and no oncologist would ever argue with us, at most 15% of cancers have some kind of genetic basis, at most. At least 85% of them don't. And even if you have cancer, so-called cancer genes, a new study found that women with the powerful breast cancer genes, if they eat enough vegetables, they can profoundly reduce their chances of ever getting breast cancer. So even if you have breast cancer genes, you can act on your chances or risk of ever having the disease by how you decide to lead your life. So lifestyle is hugely important in prevention and in helping you recover together with your treatments. And that's something that has been completely left out of how we've practiced cancer medicine. This is what I'm finding about.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the breast cancer study earlier in the interview, and you said that since the findings weren't patentable, there was no huge push to implement dietary changes based on the findings. So that's why you wrote this book, to highlight the things that aren't able to be patented and the ones that we don't hear about.
That's right. See, nobody's going to invite 100 oncologists to Hilton Head for a week to tell them about the benefits of broccoli and jogging and meditation and being friends with people you love. You know,
right.
That's just not going to happen. Whereas if there was a drug that would do half of what this can do, then all the oncologists in the world would be invited to symposia and you know their golf fees would be paid, so they would hear more about it.
You're joining us from Paris today. You also live in Pittsburgh. Your books have sold in some 30 different languages. Let me ask you, how do other countries deal with cancer in a different way than here in the U.S., specifically Europe compared to the United States, for example?
Better. Well, the United States has some of the worst rates of cancer worldwide. And it's very interesting because when you look at, say, Chinese women who live in rural China, they don't have breast cancer. It's almost impossible to find women with breast cancer in rural China, or it was a few years ago at least. But if Chinese women come and live in San Francisco, within one or two generations, they have the same rates of breast cancer as American women. So it's not about having Chinese genes. It's about having a Chinese lifestyle, and it's about our American lifestyle, which is like fertilizer for cancer growth.
Mm-hmm. And when you divide that up into diet and fitness and mental health, household product use, where do you lay the lion's share of the blame?
It's very hard to do that. I would say diet is a huge part, but we're not figuring out that just social isolation, and the independent spirit, which we're so proud of in the U.S., may actually be contributing to cancer growth as well. We're seeing studies showing that people who live a socially isolated life have a much greater risk of developing a variety of cancers. So learning how to rely on your community, be part of your community, connect with your friends, help them out, and let them help you, especially if you have cancer, that actually seems to have a huge impact on your chances of survival and doing well with the disease.
What's the feedback you've been getting to this book? How do you feel doctors, for instance, are recommending the anti-cancer lifestyle that you've researched and describe in this book?
It depends. There's been, some areas where it seemed like it was controversial. But I give lectures in hospitals all over the country. I'm just back from giving lectures at UCLA and then UCSF in California, Mount Sinai in New York. And, the physicians there were extremely interested. In fact, many of them are desperate to have something of quality and scientifically sound to give to their cancer patients who want to help themselves. And they haven't known where to turn to for that kind of information. And the book is really meant to fill that void.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying there's also a lot of responsibility lies with the patient for researching what works. But what happens when you find conflicting information? How do you separate the charlatans and the snake oil from the science?
Well, be very wary of people who suggest to you that you should stop your conventional treatments and rely only on natural interventions, because that is usually the sign of a charlatan. Be also very wary of people who offer treatments that are very expensive with no proven benefits, and be wary of natural treatments that seem like they could be dangerous with no proven benefits. So that's how I advise people to avoid charlatans.
So in the future, we have just a minute or so left. In the future, the perfect mix of traditional and new thinking about cancer is what you envision as being better for Americans, better for the world?
Absolutely. In fact, I just started a large fundraising drive with the MD Anderson Cancer Center specifically to develop a research project to focus on the very kind of interventions that are in this book, so that we can have a formal proof that if people follow this path, then their outcomes with cancer are much better, so that we can then try to roll this out onto all of conventional medicine in the country.
Okay, we wish you luck with that. Thank you very much for joining us from Paris this afternoon, this evening for you, Dr. David Servan-Schreiber. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Dr. Servan-Schreiber is author of the New York Times bestseller Anti-Cancer, just published in its new edition. Coming up in just a moment, it's Radon Action Month. We'll discuss the dangers of radon, how to test for it in your home, and how to get rid of it. If you are saying, what is radon? You need to listen to the next few minutes right here on Iowa Public Radio. This is The Exchange. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Governor Chet Culver has proclaimed January as Radon Action Month in Iowa. Radon is a colorless and odorless, tasteless gas that is naturally occurring. It causes no immediate health symptoms, but long-term exposures can cause lung cancer. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, its statistics say that radon is the leading cause of lung cancer among non-smokers. It kills more than 20,000 people a year. If this is news to you, and if you've never had your home checked for radon, you definitely want to listen to the next few minutes. Joining me to discuss the danger, the detection, and the mitigation of radon are Rick Welke with the Iowa Department of Public Health, their radon program. He joins us from Iowa Public Radio Studios in Des Moines. Good afternoon to you, Rick.
Good afternoon.
Joining us from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City, Mark Mitchell of Mark Mitchell Radon Mitigation in Iowa City. Good afternoon, Mark.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Let me start with you, Rick, for some of the more of the basics on radon. What is radon and where does it come from? How does it get into our homes?
Well, as if you've already said, radon is a naturally occurring radioactive gas. It actually comes from the natural decay of radium that was originally laid down in the soil eons ago, and it's part of our geology, and it will always be here. But the reason it is a problem is because it does seep into our homes because it's a gas. It's the inert gas, which means it doesn't react with really anything else in the environment. It just kind of stays there until it can get into your home. And as a gas, it moves in through any cracks that might be in the basement foundation. Sump areas are good places for it to come in, places where conduit is. And once it gets into your home, it can build up to a problem. If you have a dirt crawl space, it can be a problem. I mean, any home can actually be a problem or have a high radon level. And it can also have a low radon level. You just don't know until you test.
What percentage of homes in Iowa are affected, are at an actionable level? And we'll talk about that level a little later.
Mm-hmm. Well, back in the late 80s, EPA did a survey in Iowa, and they found that about 71.6% of the homes had radon levels that were 4 or above. We've also got data that has pretty much supported most of that information from back in that survey. Our data is based on all the laboratory data we get, all the data we get from measurement specialists throughout the state. And most of that data still says that we have anywhere from about 50 to 70-some percent of the homes that are still above 4 or mm-hmm. 4 or above.
Of those 70%, how many have been tested and mitigated?
Well, not very many have been mitigated, unfortunately. There's a lot of homes that have been tested. Most of the testing, I really don't have the numbers for how many homes that haven't been tested, but the homes that get tested, we get about maybe 15,000 to 20,000 tests that people buy from the laboratory devices that you can get from the local hardware store or from the Iowa Air Coalition. That you can get a hold of those test kits fairly inexpensively for about $6 or so from the Iowa Air Coalition. But they run those tests and they get analyzed at the laboratory and send the result to the homeowner, and that's generally a lot of the ways the do-it-yourselfer will do it. There's a lot of homes now that are being tested because of real estate transactions, and most of the homes that probably get mitigated are based on those real estate transactions. But last year, there was around 2,200 mitigation systems put in the state.
Mm-hmm. What are the laws concerning radon and buying and selling a home currently in our state? Federal laws, also state laws?
Well, the only laws that there actually are in Iowa for radon are to do with the licensing of the radon testers and radon mitigators. Licensed daycare facilities have to have a radon test in their facility every 2 years. On real estate basis, the only thing that actually is required, there's no testing that's actually required. Now, as of December 23rd, there's been a new real estate disclosure law that's taken effect that says that the buyer and the seller need to get radon information from the health department that is actually posted on our website, and the realtors can just download that on the website, and mm-hmm. and it's about an 8x10 sheet of paper that they can make into a brochure, and they can read that, and it has most of the radon information that a buyer and seller would want to know about.
Mm-hmm. You talked about the level, the reference level, the action level being 4.0. I think this is set by the EPA. Give me
right.
an idea of what that means. I don't know what that means. If, for instance, if I have a 4.0 in my basement or an 8 or a 9, Is that at all? We're talking about radiation, yeah. So mm-hmm. can you tell me if I was at a nuclear power plant in Palo, if that would be in any way comparable?
Well, actually, 4.0 isn't really – it's actually a number that EPA originally a long time ago came up with that was really more based on the way we – what we knew we could get radon levels below when we found problems in residential structures back in the 70s and 80s. And they knew that they could get most homes below 4 picocuries per liter. There isn't really a safe level of radon exposure because it is a radioactive gas. It is a class A carcinogen. So it actually isn't something that you really want to be exposed to at all. But there is ambient levels in our environment outside even, but it's very low. It's around 0.3, 0.4 picocuries per liter for the most part. It does vary, but and the average radon level throughout the entire nation in most residences is about 1.5 picocuries per liter. The average radon level in most Iowa homes is around 8.5.
So Iowa is a real hot spot.
Yeah, that's correct.
Unfortunately. In September of 2009, according to the information that I have, the World Health Organization changed its reference level from 4.0 down to 2.7. It recommends that countries now adopt that lower level. Any rumblings, any information there at the your department that would be attentive to the WHO's recommendations?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, EPA didn't change anything. their lit radon recommended action level is still 4.0. I do not foresee that changing, partly because of the mitigation issues that I talked about. There's not a reason at this point to change that. However, possibly in the future, I could see EPA potentially looking at newer construction and changing it to the WHO action level of 2.7 or below. I mean, that's something that we'll just have to wait and see what happens.
Our hour is quickly getting away from us. I want to get to some of the other nuts and bolts issues here, detection and then the mitigation from Mark as well. Let's talk about detection. Rick, what's the best way if you have a concern, if your house has never been tested, what do you need to do?
Well, it's simple. You can buy an inexpensive radon test kit from your hardware store. They have them usually in most of the hardware stores throughout Iowa, Lowe's, Menards. I've seen them in both places there. Or one of the best ways they can actually go get a test kit is through their county environmental health office. Most of the county environmental health offices do sell them for anywhere from $5 to $7. There's a 1-800 number, 1-800-206-7818. That's the headquarters at Linn County for the Iowa Air Coalition. They sell the test kits through the mail for $6.
I see also a radon hotline, 1-800-383-5992 for a statewide audience here.
Yeah, that's where they can get some information from us.
Definitely a good starting point there. So you use a low-cost detection kit. You find that you're above the 4.0 picocuries, mm-hmm. if I've got that right. And then
right.
we might turn also on the website of the Iowa Department of Public Health. There is a list of licensed, trained mitigators in the state by county. You can refer to that list. Mark Mitchell of Mark Mitchell Radon Mitigation in Iowa City, you are on that list. Where do you pick up the story then if someone has done a home testing kit? They call you. What happens then?
Well, normally I would visit the house, but I might add when they do run a test, we don't want to base the decision on mitigation on just one of those do-it-yourself tests. They'll need to do one more of them. Mm-hmm. So once that's completed, visit the home, take a look at it. Normally what I do is give them a written proposal on what I recommend and what it will look like and what it will cost.
So some of the houses you go to are very low levels, below 10. What's the highest level you found in Iowa in how many years of mitigation?
19.
19 years. What's the highest level you found?
I had one that was about 150 over north of Bettendorf, Iowa.
Mm. Okay. So what after you do that, what is a radon mitigation system? We see pipes coming out of houses. You put them there. What are they doing?
99% of the time, it's called subslab depressurization. We have the uranium in the soil that decays and lets the radon into the house. We learned a long time ago that it's very difficult to seal every opening. So what we do is go down under the floor and create a vacuum under there to collect the radon and give it a new path of least resistance to keep it out of the house. And this radon that we've collected on purpose is directed somewhere outdoors where it's very unlikely to get back into the house.
Mm-hmm. So if your house is on a foundation of gravel, for instance, this is a porous material. This is where that radon gas in your vacuum is pulling it out of that porous sub-foundation.
Right. We're just reversing that pressure relationship between the soil and the house. We're now creating a lower pressure under the home so the radon doesn't enter.
Okay. What kind of training goes into becoming a mitigator?
Well, you have to have a background in construction. Rick might know how many years or a degree in science, I believe, from college. Mm-hmm. I think it's still the same as I did back in 1990, a four-day class that the EPA put on and then a written test.
Mm-hmm. Rick, how rigorous is the Iowa Department of Health in making sure that the mitigators know exactly what they're doing?
Well, we try to do it as rigorously as possible. I mean, there is all the rules have at least a three-year requirement. Experience construction background. Currently, the construction background has to be at least a year and 3 years if there is no degree involved.
Mm-hmm. Have budget cuts impacted the Department of Health's radon program?
Not that much. We mostly are funded through an EPA state indoor radon grant. There is some money that currently comes in from the radon measurement specialists and the radon mitigation specialists that we license, but unfortunately that goes to the general fund and not to the program.
Mm. Let's go to Alan and Ames if you'd like to have a question about radon mitigation, its dangers, 1-866-780-9100. Alan, good afternoon.
Yes, appreciate you taking my call. This is very timely because 2 days ago I went and bought a kit.
Mm. What prompted you to do that?
I just knew I had heard about radon before, and so I knew I should have my basement checked. But the instructions don't say much. They say put the two containers on a flat surface. But should I put them on the floor?
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Rick for that. How do you use these kits?
The protocols for I don't know which type of kit he actually has, but no, you don't want to put them on the floor. You need to have them at least a couple feet off the floor, up to potentially 6 feet above the floor. Most of the times you can find a surface that you can put it like a bookshelf or a nightstand or something like that.
Some counters down there. And should I put them in different parts of the basement? I mean, put one in.
Do you have a finished part of the basement at all? I mean, is there a spot that you can that's finished, or is it a non-finished basement?
Oh, it's about half finished.
Okay. If you have a place where you are at that it isn't going to be disturbed, that's a good spot to put it at. If you can try to put it at least a foot off the wall and not near any doors or openings, that would also be a good idea.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll find a couple of spots down there. Suppose I don't spend any time in my basement. Is it still going to be a concern?
Well, I mean, some does get upstairs, yeah. I mean, and okay. There's the rule of thumb is that at least 50 to 75% of the radon that's downstairs eventually will be upstairs. And, I mean, if you tested upstairs, you would have about 50 to 75% of the reading upstairs. But that's just a rule of thumb. I mean, you really would have to test the upstairs at the same time.
Yeah, the only time I'm in the basement is when I'm doing laundry.
Okay. All right, Alan, thank you very much. Okay. So it really depends on how much time you spend in your basement. For sure, if you have someone, a bedroom in the basement.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That would be a good indicator that you want to do some testing, possible mitigation. What about homes without basements? Do you still need to do testing if you don't have one?
Oh, absolutely. You can have a trailer with metal skirting or skirting around the outside of the trailer. It still can have high radon levels.
Mm-hmm. What if your home was affected by flooding in 2008? Will that change any radon levels, wash it away?
Absolutely not. I mean, anything can change radon level if you do ventilation issues or you do remodeling and things like that. But we do recommend that, you know, every 2 to 3 years you think about doing a test. If you have a mitigation system put in, you still should test every, 4 years or so. The mitigation systems do a really good job giving a permanent radon level that would be generally low, hopefully, in the home. So,
Mark, you come into contact with people concerned about radon, mitigating radon every day, every week, people who perhaps 3 or 4 weeks ago didn't know what radon was, and all of a sudden they're alerted to it. I am astounded, just reading the statistics here, 20,000 people a year die from lung cancer caused by radon. It's the leading cause of lung cancer among non-smokers. Mark, are you surprised that we aren't raising awareness more quickly, more effectively in this state?
Well, they've done studies in the past, and the fact that it's colorless and odorless has a lot to do with it. It's easy to ignore.
So when you breathe it, you're not going to get any symptoms or anything. You don't know it's there. It's just invisible.
We used to, if radon had an odor to it, it'd be a much different issue. If you walked in somebody's house and took one whiff and said, "Oh man, you got radon," it'd be a lot different.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it's the power of positive thinking. You can put the statistics in front of people, and I guess if you say 71.6% of the homes test high, most people think that they'll probably fall into the other category.
Mm-hmm. So we said that Iowa is a hot spot for radon. Unfortunately, an average of 8-point-something picocuries. Is that reflected? I mean, Iowans, we've been here a number of generations. Is that reflected in national lung cancer statistics? Can we separate that out from, say, the ones caused by smoking?
Yeah, there's a lot of research that's been done on radon throughout the centuries. I mean, radon is probably the most studied carcinogen and the most studied pollutant there is as far as the data that we have. I mean, we've got the data is there that basically does all the controversy used to be, well, does it really cause lung cancer? Does it do this? Does it do that? That's not the issue anymore. The issue is at what level can a person actually get lung cancer in their home from radon exposure? And we know today that it was a lot lower than what we originally thought it maybe would have been. And the EPA really had this one right. 4 picocuries per liter is really the number we should be striving to get most homes down to, and 2.7 it may be a number in the future. So there's lots and lots of research and data on radon throughout history, and we've got more data on this subject than all the other pollutants combined.
Let's go to Sharon in Johnston. Thank you for joining us, Sharon. Your question or comment about radon?
Well, I had two. First of all, are there any areas that are really the hot spots in Iowa for high levels of radon that you know about? And secondly, what are the legal requirements for disclosure of radon levels for buying and selling a house?
Okay, let's go to those hot spots, because on the website you do have a document that shows the county by county breakdown, where the number of tests that have been done and the number of tests that exceed the 4.0 level. Talk about that.
You know, that data or that map is really a lot more qualitative than quantitative. That map basically is just to show people that it can be anywhere. I mean, you really do have to test your home. You can have two homes sitting side by side, and I've had homes where one was 100 and something and another one was below 2.
Okay.
So you just don't know unless you test. And for the data that we had when EPA and the data that we're getting even today, There's a general trend that in the northern part of the state, there definitely is a little higher averages up in the northern part of the state compared to the southern part of the state, but the whole state has high radon. The whole entire state has a problem.
Okay, quickly, the second part of Sharon's question about the legal disclosure.
The only thing, I mean, that's not our rule. It's actually the Real Estate Commission rule, and that was something they just put out in December, and so that's actually the only thing there is on disclosure is that the person that's buying the home is supposed to get that brochure from us that discusses radon, gives them the real facts on radon. And if the buyer and seller both see that, generally most buyers especially would want to do a test on the home.
Okay, Sue from Marshalltown is our last caller. Hi, Sue.
Hi. You know, there are a lot of other reasons that you might want to air your house out and get fresh air in. So why bother with a radon test? Why not just do a regularly open up your windows and air the house out, which is what I do. And if, you know, when I do that, I like, how often do I really need to do that? You know, let's just assume, say, the level is 25.
Okay, let's go to Mark for that, please. Yeah.
Well, have you tested your house for radon?
No.
Well, first off, I'd run a test because some houses, even if you're doing some ventilation like that, still might very well average above 4. And the other thing, let's say you tested it with the doors and windows closed and it was, say, 8. It's still awful expensive in months like this to use ventilation as a method to get the levels down.
Mm-hmm. Are there construction methods? I know, a home builder, former home builder, before you specialized in this. Construction methods being developed that will prevent radon gas from seeping from our foundations up into our basements?
You know? Yes. Here in Johnson County, they're very progressive. All of our municipalities and in the county have adopted Appendix F of the building codes, which requires radon-resistant new construction in a certain manner that basically installs a passive radon system, and it really helps.
Okay, it sounds like you need to, probably good idea to get your house tested rather than airing out so much.
Can I ask another question?
No, we don't have time. I'm sorry. Thank you, Sue, from Marshalltown. Very quickly, to Rick here, if you could wish for any legislation that would lessen the danger of radon to Iowans, what would it be?
Well, probably real estate, mandatory real estate testing, and that would be probably the most important one, because a lot of people, when you do that, will probably end up doing a test for sure.
And other states have this stricter legislation?
Well, they have them in Zone 1 areas, what we call an EPA Zone 1 area.
Mm-hmm. Quickly.
But there's nothing, yeah, there's nothing here at this point, and our whole state is Zone 1.
Okay, very good. Rick Welke, Iowa Department of Public Health Radon Program, thank you very much.
I thank you.
Mark Mitchell of Mark Mitchell Radon Mitigation in Iowa City, thank you for coming in as well.
Thank you.
The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Jeff Schmidt. Our producer assistant today, Christoph Mai. We always welcome your comments and questions. You can put them to The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org by email. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
Talk of the Nation next at 1 from